Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a look inside of Iran to gauge the attitudes of its people as the country waits for a retaliation from Israel that could lead to a wider war. Joining us is Asal Rudd, the former research director of the National Iranian American Council and the author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. We'll discuss today's announcements by the Secretary of the Treasury that the U.S. is considering imposing more sanctions on Iran, whose economy is beset with more than 40% inflation and a shrinking middle class as the clerical elite and Revolutionary Guards rob the country blind. Then we'll look into the symbiosis between Israel's hardline Prime Minister Netanyahu and Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, who both oppose a two-state solution for the Palestinians and have delusions of global influence. Joining us is Mansour Farang, a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish Civil War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Then finally, we'll assess today's oral arguments before the Supreme Court in a case that could undo felony charges against hundreds of January the 6th insurrectionists and dismiss half of the charges Trump faces in the Washington, D.C. trial. Joining us is Claire Finkelstein, who is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also the founder and faculty director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Her current research focuses on national security law and policy, democratic governance, and professional ethics, and her books include the Oxford Series in Ethics, National Security and the Rule of Law, and most recently, Between Crime and War, Hybrid Legal Frameworks for Asymmetrical Conflict. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Asal Rudd, who is the former research director of the National Iranian American Council and is the author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asal Rudd.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what are you hearing from Iran itself, from the street, so to speak, given that the Secretary of Treasury today, Janet Yellen, has announced more sanctions against Iran. Israel is poised to strike back in retaliation against the Iranian missile and drone attack on Israel, which was in retaliation for an Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which killed some IRGC generals. So I imagine, even though there's that rally around the flag effect that you have when a country's at war, is there other feelings going on inside Iran? Is that what you're hearing? Or are they basically supporting this government, even though many people, particularly women, seem to hate it?
I think there's definitely, the first thing to keep in mind is how diverse this country is, right? We're talking about a country of well over 80 million people with diverse backgrounds and that have views across the political spectrum. One of the things to keep in mind is that the Islamic Republic, while I agree with your sentiment, certainly is that a majority certainly seem to take issue with the entirety of the government, with the concept of the Islamic Republic, and the way that this government has governed its own people. There is, though, a minority, a base of support still for the Islamic Republic within the country, right? There's this hardline sort of camp that has now consolidated power. And there are people, millions of people within the country, who really their livelihoods depend on it, or they perceive at least their livelihoods to depend on the survival of that state. And so, and what they lack in quantity, they sort of make up in fervor. So there's a very strong support within that. And so that is some of the pressure that you see for the government to act when there's an attack on an Iranian consulate or embassy, as we saw in Damascus. There is that hardline camp that wants the government to act and in retaliation, in response to that. Overall, though, I mean, there's certainly people who I think go across the spectrum. You might have people on one extreme that want, that have that rally around the flag effect and want to see the Iranian government respond. And then you have people probably on the other extreme who may even feel that this sort of attack is almost welcome because they're so dissatisfied and so angry with the current government. But I think what you'll probably see is people more spread in the middle, and that tends to be the case in every state, in every population, right? You can have people on different extremes of the polls, but really, these are people whose day-to-day concern is their own livelihoods, how they're going to feed their families, how they're going to afford basic necessities of life, how they can, you know, if you're young, how are you going to be employed in an economy that is spiraling or has been spiraling for so many years under mismanagement and corruption, as well as U.S. sanctions. So there's a really a lot of different factors and elements that are calculating in the psyche of people of that country, and they have a diverse set of views. So that's the one thing I think is the most important, that there really isn't one way to sort of paint the entire population.
And I just mentioned that the Secretary of Treasury is increasing new, or is now imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran. The official inflation rate in Iran is just over 40%. So that would indicate there are a lot of people struggling to get by.
Absolutely. And that's, and not surprisingly, that's the number one thing people are concerned about. Of course, they're concerned about the political repression. Of course, they're concerned about the social repression. But ultimately, and again, we see this everywhere. We see this in every country. People, the first concern is their ability to live. And while they live under this kind of economic pressure, where something else to keep in mind is while you have this kind of economic pressure on the country, there are still people who are very, very wealthy. There is still an elite class that even, especially the, you know, the sort of most corrupt elements within the state actually benefit in a system of sanctions, because they're the ones who can get around sanctions, whereas ordinary people cannot do that. So you have an ordinary population, a middle class that's basically disappearing. Many millions of middle class have been forced into poverty because of the economic situation. And so that's a central concern that people have. And of course, while sanctions are an issue, and it was one of the reasons that drove Iranians in, say, 2013 and 2017 to vote in significant numbers, hoping that there would be an Iranian administration that would have a deal with the United States and relieve sanctions, we've seen the decline in any participation in voting in the last several elections because of the fact that that really didn't bear any fruit, right? You had the U.S. withdraw from that, from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, reimpose sanctions, and sanctions have been just increasing year by year since then. So the economic situation is very bad. People are suffering greatly. And I think that's a lot of what's feeding the dissatisfaction with the current state of affairs, in addition to the political and social repression that we obviously see as well.
So do a lot of Iranians then wonder why this government is so focused on Palestinians and the Palestinian cause and funds Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis, etc., in this axis of resistance that its foreign policy is based on? I mean, not that they have a lot of agency, because we saw the women rise up against the regime over headscarves and they were brutally put down. So obviously it's dangerous to raise your head in protest, but nevertheless, I think under the surface, a lot of people are going to be wondering is why if we're struggling, why is the focus on taking care of Palestinians and not taking care of us, the average Iranian citizen?
Absolutely, and that's long been a sentiment. In fact, if you go back to protests in 2009 after the contested elections in the Green Movement, one of the protest chants that has been used since then invokes that exact message, right? Why it's not Lebanon, not Gaza, it's we sacrifice our lives for Iran. That's essentially the paraphrasing of the translation. And so there's this idea that the allocation of resources to foreign policy issues, to these militias that are aligned with Iran within the region, are taking away from resources from people in the country who need it. And this is, again, sort of paralleled with what we see even in our own country, in the U.S., where you have people who are struggling economically and then take issue with giving military aid to other countries or just the amount of money that the U.S. spends on its military, right? So this is like a very logical position for them to take, which is, we have limited resources. Why are those resources being allocated for causes outside of the country when people inside of the country are suffering? So that's certainly a sentiment. And again, that sort of goes across the spectrum. There are people within the country who agree with this being, and again, they're a minority, but who agree with this defensive posture of the Iranian state. And that's why you see sometimes these, even though Iran in many cases has shown a restrained reaction, sometimes they're compelled to respond to that base that actually supports them. And then you have people, of course, across the spectrum who are absolutely against anything being spent, any resources being allocated for that. And then that doesn't necessarily mean that the entire population, for instance, doesn't understand the plight of Palestinians, right? There's people, again, across the spectrum who have different views. But even for those who might sympathize with the Palestinian cause and find Israel's actions, to take issue with Israel's actions, nonetheless, the state of affairs in the country is their number one concern. And so there is definitely a large pushback against resources being allocated for things that don't actually help people in Iran.
So these sanctions that Janet Yellen is talking about, thinking about, I guess, they haven't imposed them yet, but they're supposedly going to be going against the oil sector. So I'm wondering why, for example, Japan's foreign minister has spoken to her Iranian counterpart urging restraint. Putin has apparently said the same thing to President Raisi of Iran, according to TASS. And he was assured that Tehran was not seeking to escalate tensions any further. China's foreign minister also spoke on the phone with Iran's foreign minister, again, urging restraint. So what's going on there? In other words, are they afraid? Because we know that China gets a lot of its oil from Iran. Are they afraid of the price of oil going up? Or why? On the one hand, are the Chinese and the Russians, who would seem to have another motive, which is to drag America further into the Middle East, when America's for the last decade or so has been trying to get out of the Middle East so it can concentrate on Ukraine, for example, which the distraction of Gaza has definitely impacted Ukraine and has been a gift to Putin. And she is probably perfectly happy to have the United States distracted in the Middle East once again, rather than focusing on Taiwan or the Pacific region.
I think there's, you know, I would, the idea that the U.S. has tried to withdraw from the Middle East is, if you look at the last 6 months, that's clearly not the case, right? If we wanted to see de-escalation, the quickest, swiftest, and, you know, most abiding by international law, in terms of abiding by international law, method of doing that would have been to support a ceasefire in Gaza, which had overwhelming support in the international community. It's something that the U.S. essentially alone decided to undermine over and over again by using its diplomatic power, its veto power at the U.N. Security Council, voting against the General Assembly resolutions. And then finally, when a ceasefire resolution was passed, because the U.S. abstained, deciding that UN resolutions were suddenly non-binding, right? So there's a problem in the way that the US has approached the last 6 months to then come back and use those same institutions that in certain ways have been undermined by the US itself to then hold, say, a country like Iran accountable. One of the, I think when you talk about, you know, Russia, China, all these different parties who obviously have a vested interest in what happens, I think for the most part, everyone wants to, and this includes Iran and the United States, I think everyone wants to avoid a larger war because it will benefit nobody, right? If you look at the region itself, in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Jordan, all of these countries have repeatedly said they don't want to see an escalation, and it's been matched by their actions. And even in the case of the Iranian response to Israel's bombing of its embassy in Damascus, they have said that, and as far as they're concerned, this matter is closed. There was an attack by Israel and a response by Iran, and there doesn't need to be anything else outside of that. So now it's the decision again of Israel, and we're seeing the Biden administration want to, at least in this particular case, vote what they're saying publicly is that they want to restrain Israel from a retaliation that would create a larger escalation. I think oil is one reason. Obviously, so much of the world's oil and energy resources are coming from that region, but also because it can affect, it has reverberating effects. The more instability that exists in the region, not only is oil an issue, but other commerce is an issue, as well as how much this can create, the scale of how far it can go is unpredictable. And I think that is something, those are very real fears and appropriate fears that anyone should have. And so I think across the board, there should be restraint. And we're seeing that within the leadership of all of these countries.
Well, just in closing, then, Netanyahu has all the leverage over Biden, who has never been able to really restrain him, it appears. And the idea that the gas prices could be $5 or $6 a gallon, $6 or $7 a gallon at election time would be devastating for Biden. So at the end of the day, this is all up to this Israeli leader who needs to keep the war going in order to stay in power and stay out of jail. So is that the situation? The world is held hostage by this one man?
I think that's somewhat true, but at the same time, the issue with Biden's inability to restrain Netanyahu has been that Biden has not really tried to. The Biden has a list of tools at his disposal, and we saw what even a little bit of pressure, right? One phone call after the killing of World Central Kitchen aid workers, obviously that got a lot of public attention, a lot of media attention, especially in Western media, even though we had seen, you know, more than 200 aid workers have already been killed in Gaza. But that particular incident brought so much global attention and condemnation that it forced President Biden's hand. And in one phone call, we saw bakeries reopening, we saw more crossings open to allow more aid in. And that means that could have happened months ago, right? So there's a lot at President Biden's, he has a lot of leverage if he wanted to use it. And past American presidents have done so. There's the sort of infamous case of Ronald Reagan in the early 1980s with one phone call stopping the bombing in Lebanon. So it's not that there's no way for the U.S. to act. It's not all on, the actions of Netanyahu, obviously he's responsible for his own actions, but this administration has the power to change the dynamic of what's happening, has the power to really de-escalate if it wants to. It's really a choice as to whether or not it wants to use those levers, and not even punitive levers, right? You don't even have to go that far. It could be something as simple as actually conditioning military aid to Israel, which is, by the way, something that's part of U.S. domestic law. Aid to a country, if a country is using U.S. weapons to carry out atrocities, there are U.S. laws that prohibit weapons transfers. If a U.S. aid is being blocked, there are laws that prohibit giving military aid to those countries. So really all anybody is asking for is that President Biden abide by international law and U.S. domestic law. And in doing so, he can restrain Netanyahu and de-escalate the situation from getting any worse than it already is.
Well, Asal Rada, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Asal Rad, who is a former research director of the National Iranian American Council and the author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the symbiosis between Israel's hardline Prime Minister Netanyahu and Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, who both oppose a two-state solution for Palestinians and have delusions of global influence.
اگه دیدی درد مردم و ولی چشاتو بستی، ظلم به مظلوم رو دیدی و از کنارش رفتی، اگه از ترس یا واسه منفعتت خوده کردی، تو هم دست ظالم هستی، تو هم مجرم هستی. اگه خودتو به خواب زدی وقتی که خونا رو میریختن، گرفتار کسبتی وقتی جون جوونا رو میگیرن.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mansour Farang, who is a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime refused to accept UN recommendations to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, the Spanish Civil War to the Iranian Revolution, and the U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy, and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farang.
Thank you very much, Will.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mansour. And we've spoken in the past, and you've made the point that there's a sort of somewhat sick symbiosis between the hardliner in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the hardliners in Iran, including the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, not to mention, of course, Khamenei's son, who's also high up in the IRGC. So this retaliation against Israel's strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killing the IRGC generals, was obviously done to placate the IRGC, and they apparently have taken credit for all the missiles and drones that they showered down on Israel a few days ago. But now the country is poised for some kind of response from Israel. And does your thesis still hold that there's a symbiosis between the hawks on both sides, that they feed off each other?
Yes, it does. Actually, to understand the ironic tragedy of what is going on in the confrontation between Israel and Iran is, first of all, to understand that these two countries have absolutely no conflict of interest. So the confrontation has to do with ideology, opportunism, and use of each side's position or priorities for propagandistic purposes. In other words, we have to understand the mutual interdependency between Benjamin Netanyahu and Ayatollah Ali Khamenei in order to understand what is going on, that people in Israel and people in Iran are paying the price of the confrontation between two, I would say, people who really demonstrate, you know, pathological elements in their behavior. Iran's attack on Israel was a paradigm shift from attacking Israel through its proxies to direct military confrontation with Israel. And the attack was as much intended to be a display of force against Israel as it was to bolster the regime's image among its regional proxies, as well as the more radical elements of the Revolutionary Guards. So, in other words, we are talking about Netanyahu and Khamenei, who are really intimate enemies. And whatever they do, it has to do either with ideology, with, in my view, pathological view of what this conflict is about, or the use of Iran's hostility toward, you know, Israel in order to generate anti-Palestinian movement, in other words, to marginalize or reject the Palestinians who want peace. In other words, Israel and Iran are the only members of the United Nations that are openly and actively opposed to the two-state solution. This is the nature of the reality. And what we are facing, you know, in fact, what Iran did, very fascinating, that days earlier, at least 3 days earlier, the United States, European countries, and the Arab countries were informed what Iran was going to do. So in other words, the preparedness, that the coordination and the effectiveness of the United States, Great Britain, France, and Jordan, and Saudi Arabia in preventing these drones or the missiles reaching, you know, Israel, 99% of them, as they say, because they already knew about it. They knew that, but they were prepared for it. This is exactly what I didn't know that until I read an interview that the Iranian foreign minister gave in Iran. So it's really, we are facing a tragic situation that all countries are involved and nobody knows exactly what is the purpose of this confrontation.
So if we don't know what the purpose of this confrontation is, even though it's the centerpiece of Iran and Israel's relations in the region, and it's holding the whole region hostage and holding the price of oil hostage, which is the last thing that Joe Biden needs in this election year, is this meant to just to continue on simmering in this theatrical way? Because as you pointed out, the Iranian regime more or less gave a heads up that all the missiles were coming. And then the UN mission said, you know, after we'd fire these missiles, the issue was closed. So that was a clear signal that it was in a way of a sort of theatrical response. But I'm just wondering whether there's, I know that Netanyahu would like the United States to help him take down the Iranian regime, but now Biden is making clear that he doesn't want to do that. And not that I think he ever wanted to do that. So is there ever going to be a showdown here, or are we just going to have this sort of theater of the symbiosis between these hawks on both sides?
Exactly. It is not a show. It is a tragic, you know, reality. The Iranian regime, from the very beginning, and when we look at its constitution, it rejects the idea of nationalism. It rejects the idea of national interest, that is the welfare, security, and prestige of the nation. They do not concern them. They're interested in what they refer to in Arabic or in their own vocabulary, ummat, that is, which is another word for imperialism. They want to create a kind of imperial or ummat under the control of the Iranian regime. In other words, from the very beginning, ideologically speaking, Khomeini and Khamenei wanted to transform the conflict between Palestinians and the Israeli state into a conflict and confrontation between Israel and Islam. And they claimed, and they continue to claim, that they represent revolutionary Islam. But they have spent hundreds of billions of dollars in pursuit of this idea, and then logic, you know, common sense would tell us it is an absurdity for the country to be rejecting the legitimacy of another state and even ignoring the people who are suffering from the racism of the present Israeli, you know, government. In other words, Iran, contrary to the claims they make in their publicity, the Islamic Republic of Iran has not helped the Palestinians. In fact, it only helps those Palestinian radicals whose constitution and whose behavior really contains anti-Semitism and reject the very idea of peaceful resolution of the conflict. Mahmoud Abbas, who has opposed to violence for 50 years, and he has never questioned the legitimacy of Israel, but Iranians are not even willing to talk to him. In other words, it's very interesting. Going back 30 years ago, when Yasser Arafat and Isaac Rabin met in Washington, supporters of Arafat were expelled from Iran, and Arafat was described as an agent of Israel or an agent of the United States. At the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu played a central, he accused Esav Rabin of violating the tradition of values of Judaism. And he created, even some of his supporters compared him with Hitler, compared him with Nazis, and created an environment that he was assassinated by a radical religious character in Israel. And in Egypt, when Anwar Sadat made peace with Israel, the Iranian regime rejected it. And they, in fact, when he was assassinated, they named a street after his assassin in Tehran. It's fascinating the way the thinking of it. In other words, even Netanyahu, in 2019 gave a speech in the Knesset of Israel, and in defending the assistance that he was supporting, $1.5 billion going from Qatar to Hamas, he said, anybody who is opposed to the creation of an independent Palestinian state must support Hamas. And he did. In other words, dividing the Palestinians, creating fragmentation and atomization among them was the goal of the right-wing people in Israel, particularly the present coalition government. This is exactly what Khomeini did. Any Palestinian who wanted to engage in peaceful negotiation with Israelis, many of whom also supporting peace and negotiation. In other words, Netanyahu and Ali Khamenei are equally opposed to the idea of a negotiated settlement. And therefore, they're both doing everything in their power in order to discredit and demoralize Palestinians who are pursuing legitimate and peaceful means to resolve their conflict. It's really fascinating. In other words, they're intimate enemies. They're intimate enemies.
So just in the last minute then, Mansour Farrakh, in addition to your thesis that there's a symbiosis between Netanyahu and the Ayatollah Khamenei, they also seem to share delusions of grandeur. I mean, Netanyahu clearly thinks he rules the world. He's got this tiny little country that gets so much attention, particularly from the U.S. and the U.S. taxpayer. It's the most heavily subsidized country in the world, and yet it's a very successful economy. It doesn't really need the money. And world leaders have to line up to get an invitation to the Senate or the House or the White House, but he just picks up the phone and shows up. I mean, it's amazing how much, so much power. I mean, I can understand why he's delusional about how important he is and how important the state of Israel is, and it is. A lot of people in this country think of it as the number one most important country in terms of our foreign policy. And look at what's happening to poor Ukraine. Israel gets all the help and the missiles and the defense while they're prosecuting a war that most people on the planet think is disgraceful. But poor Ukraine can't get a damn thing out of the U.S., particularly out of the House. And then you've just explained to us how the Iranian regime has these delusions about being this the champions of Islam and being not just a regional power, but a global power. So is that the case as well?
Exactly. The delusion is extended to Israel as well as sometimes to some groups in the United States. I was in Israel several years ago with a group of American academics, and I never forget when we went to one of these communities that have been the radical religious people controlled it. One colleague asked the leader of the group, he said, what is your purpose? What is your purpose in expansionism here and ignoring the Palestinian rights? He took his Torah out of his pocket and started reading that the biblical land of Israel from Nile to Euphrates. When we talk about, and today, some members, these groups, these radical religious groups dominate Netanyahu's cabinet. And they do have that they want to, they think the entire land and no one else, the Palestinians should go and live in other countries where they can speak Arabic and they have the same religion and so forth. To what extent they have some believers and there are others who use this as an instrument of pursuing their political and economic interests. It's fascinating. In the United States, some radical religious people in the United States have come up and they have very close relationship with Netanyahu. When Netanyahu comes to the United States, or radical religious Americans go to Israel, they get together and talk about that. It's really fascinating and absurd at the same time. The right-wing religious people in the United States who work closely with Israel, they say, when Israel is able to take over the biblical land of Israel, Jesus will come back.
Right, the second coming, the end of time. And we all end up in the lake of fire.
So you're really dealing
burning.
With an absurdity.
I know.
That
it's spiritual.
It's millions of human beings.
It's spiritual pornography. But that's exactly. That's a way to. I thank you. We've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us here today, Mansour Farhang.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And again, I may speak with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor emeritus of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Ayatollah Khamenei's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish Civil War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of today's oral arguments before the Supreme Court in a case that could undo felony charges against hundreds of January 6 insurrectionists and dismiss half of the charges Trump faces in the Washington, D.C. trial. So welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Claire Finkelstein, who is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also the founder and faculty director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law and the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Her current research addresses national security, law and policy, democratic governance, and professional ethics, and her books include the Oxford Series of Ethics, National Security and the Rule of Law, and most recently, Between Crime and War, Hybrid Legal Frameworks for Asymmetrical Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Claire Finkelstein.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the extent to which you've dealt with, for example, hybrid warfare and asymmetrical conflict, which is the way wars are nowadays, no great powers like in World War One or World War Two are going to war against each other, but subnational and transnational conflicts have afflicted us ever since the end of the Cold War. But how would you then relate the work that you do on the global stage with what happened on January the 6th? That seemed to be a fairly violent insurrection and a direct attack at the heart of American democracy.
Well, that's right. And we have to think on many levels at once. Of course, we have a president at that time who was very close to an outside foreign power, a superpower, namely Russia, may have encouraged and supported his efforts all along the way, and probably the full extent of that is not known. So just in terms of making the link between the efforts of superpowers to control global events and domestic events, we can tie them together that way. But really as separate subject matters, we, of course, had a president who was convinced that he had won an election he had not won, and played a significant role, as far as we can tell, in working up his supporters to engage in a violent insurrection on the Capitol building. And we're dealing ever since then with the fallout in the criminal justice system and trying to ensure that there is the ability to bring about the kind of accountability that our domestic legal system really needs to ensure that this
kind of occurrence does not reoccur. But it's extremely difficult to do. And of course, this is the largest investigation and conspiracy prosecution, set of prosecutions that the Justice Department has engaged in its history.
So in terms of Putin's hold over Trump, which is mysterious but nevertheless very real, the Russian press, and so to some extent the Chinese propaganda organs, are full of encouragement for what they call Texit, the secession of Texas. And civil war is also being discussed and almost encouraged. So is Trump the gift that keeps on giving as far as Putin's concerned? Because he obviously, you know, going back to his KGB days, he was always obsessed with the sort of Glavny Protivnik notion of the main enemy. And the Russian investment in Brexit, for example, which is still to this day paralyzed the UK, was something like £9 million. But the effects were monumental. And I'm just thinking in terms of Trump getting Putin off the hook in Ukraine, which would be a major incentive. But in just in general, it seems that what's happening here is that basically this could be, if it's ever proven, and obviously the waters were muddied by the Mueller report, etc., this would be one of the greatest intelligence operations since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar and sent him to Russia in 1917.
Well, look, we had enormous activity of this sort in the run-up to the 2016 election, not just the Texas exit, but there was Cal exit, an effort to convince Californians that they might, that California ought to secede from the union. There was the a false website that suggested a grassroots movement to give Alaska back to the Russians. So there were, and then, as you say, there was the Russian influence on the Brexit movement. So the Russians have been engaging in this kind of disinformation and political influence campaign for so many years. And we've seen that alongside its malicious cyber activity for many, many years, going all the way back to Estonia, back several years earlier. And we can expect that to happen again. And there's a lot in the run up to the current presidential election. There's a lot of suggestion that Russia is gearing up again to do its very best to try to help Trump in this election. And of course, the trials and the accountability for Trump's potentially criminal activity and the four indictments. We can expect the Russians possibly to be engaging in disinformation and influence peddling around public opinion with regard to that as well. So we really don't know what the role of the Russians will be in engaging in this kind of disinformation. I agree with what you said about the Mueller report. It is a shame that it was... that it did to some extent muddy the waters and did not come out with a very clear and definitive answer to the question whether or not there had been significant influence in the election by Russian meddling and whether or not the Trump campaign had been very directly a kind of conspiracy with that foreign power to win the election. But that was a report based on looking for criminal liability. So whether or not there were the formal elements of a criminal conspiracy met really doesn't fully settle the question of whether or not U.S. national security and our critical electoral infrastructure was being undermined by the connection between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence assets and malign foreign influence. I think that's something that we're going to have to watch very, very carefully as we go into the current presidential election.
So let's talk about today's oral arguments in the Supreme Court over the law called Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which was passed back in the days of the Enron scandal in the early 2000s. And it criminalizes the destruction of evidence and of records and documents that were shredded. But it also says, penalize anyone who, quote, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. And that was the law, that, among others, that has led to the felony convictions of, I think, over 100 at least, of the January 6 insurrectionists. The case was brought to the Supreme Court by a Pennsylvania police officer who was arrested on January the 6th, Joseph Fisher. Trump, of course, has called the insurrectionist heroes and plays the J6 choir singing the national anthem at all of his rallies. So there's no doubt about where Trump stands on this, and he would be the beneficiary if this law is overturned.
That's
or at least
right.
this. Right. So let's talk about the consequences here of the Supreme Court. And you have to note that at least four of the conservative justices, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch in particular, were very skeptical of this law being applied to.
Right. So the worry here is that there was an earlier case, a 2015 case, in which the Supreme Court was very divided, that applied this law to a case of commercial fishermen who were caught with undersized fish. And the fishermen had ordered the undersized fish to be tossed overboard before authorities could confirm that they had violated the fishing ordinances. And they were convicted of a related crime that prohibited people from altering or destroying any record, document, or tangible object with the intent to obstruct an investigation. And the Supreme Court held in that case that a tangible object used to record or preserve information had to be a document, but not a fish. So here in this case, and the pun is a bit amusing, in the Fisher case, which is what this is, no relation to the earlier fishing case. the argument is that, in fact, it is like that case, and that trying to engage in an attack on the Capitol to prevent the certification from taking place is like throwing a fish overboard. This particular law should not apply to it because this law was meant to apply to documents. But the law, it's very technical. The law that was applied in the 2015 case is slightly different from this law. And this law separates out the section involving documents from the section which is a generalized obstruction statute. So the argument of the government is that Fisher here is being prosecuted for engaging and attempting to obstruct the certification of the vote, which is a legal process, and that it has nothing to do with documents whatsoever, and that the documents provision is in a separate section, which doesn't apply to this section. So that's what the Supreme Court has to consider now, needs to address this. And it has profound impact for Donald Trump because he has been charged with the same section. So he will try to make the same argument and, in fact, will be able to if the Supreme Court says in this case that trying to stop the certification of an election and trying to, in effect, overthrow the U.S. government in doing so cannot be considered obstruction under these federal obstruction laws.
So the final ruling will come down in June. And as I say, reading the tea leaves today in the oral arguments, it did seem that at least four of the conservative justices were sympathetic to overturning the law and sympathetic to the convicted felons for January the 6th. And if the Supreme Court does rule that the law doesn't apply to these January 6th rioters, Trump then could seek dismissal of half of the charges he's facing in the Washington, D.C. case that's being stalled by the very same Supreme Court who've taken up this idea of presidential immunity, even though most legal scholars say it's pretty specious to begin with. So what do you think?
Right, and as you may be aware, I filed along with Richard Painter and 13 other amici, an amicus brief in the immunity case, to argue that it would be extremely dangerous to grant to any president immunity from criminal acts that are performed in a president's official capacity. And one of the things that we argue, and we had significant military, retired military signing on to this brief with us, to say that it would be extremely damaging for the chain of command to have immunity for the commander-in-chief in issuing potentially illegal orders, because those subordinates in the chain of command are used to being able to count on the legality of presidential orders. And it is a crime, of course, for anybody in the military chain of command to follow an illegal order, as we know, of course, from Nuremberg, but also from our own codes and our own military practices and court-martial instructions. You are not permitted, it is illegal to carry out an illegal order, and you can be court-martialed for that. So an illegal order cannot carry through the chain. But if the president issues an illegal order, there will be a strong gravitational pull for others in the chain of command to follow his lead and to apply that order down through the chain. So it's really, really critical to get this right. And we believe that if a president were entitled to issue illegal orders and have immunity in doing so, that would be extremely damaging for good discipline and order in the military chain of command.
But just in closing, Claire Finkelstein, just aside from the fact that this immunity claim on the part of Trump seems pretty specious, and it does seem unlikely that the Supreme Court would make such a radical ruling in his favor, the practical implications so far are simply to delay the January 6th case of Judge Chutkan's, right? And that in itself plays into Trump's hands.
Well, absolutely. Every bit of delay plays into Trump's hands. And even having gone so far with this immunity case very much did that. I don't know why the Supreme Court, and I guess we'll find out when we hear the oral arguments next week, why the Supreme Court decided to grant cert on this. That makes me very nervous. The D.C. Circuit wrote an excellent opinion below, very, very detailed, very compelling, and the Supreme Court should have just left it at that. But there must have been some reason why they wanted to consider this. Maybe they felt it was important to speak from the highest court in the land on the issue of immunity, so that there would be no doubt in anybody's mind that a sitting president is not immune to criminal charges for official capacity acts. That is a possibility, because throughout its history, whenever the Supreme Court has considered presidential immunity with regard to criminal matters, it has been very clear in U.S. v. Nixon, for example, and then most recently in Trump v. Vance, that there simply is no immunity to criminal investigations, criminal charges, to the criminal justice system in general. For presidents. So, the president is not above the law, and the Supreme Court has made that clear time and again.
Well, Claire Finkelstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Of course. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Claire Finkelstein, who's a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also the founder and faculty director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Her current research addresses national security law and policy, democratic governance, and professional ethics, and her books include the Oxford Series in Ethics, National Security and the Rule of Law, and most recently, Between Crime and War, Hybrid Legal Frameworks for Asymmetrical Conflict. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.